Good morning. It's an historic day in American politics. A woman is the presumptive presidential candidate of a political party. And we'll talk with news analyst Neil Conan about that and other of the week's stories later in the hour. And continuing our look at what's up with Maui, State Labor Director Linda Chu Takayama considers the Maui jobs market. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
I'm Chris Vandercook. English majors, cover your ears. Every song in Kauai Voice's upcoming show has the word ain't in it. Musical director Randy Lena will tell us how he picked them. And there's an art exhibit at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center with a story to tell. Scott Yole of the Agro Collective on the rat and the octopus.
It's Tuesday, June 7th. Stay here for all the conversation coming up after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Looking at the shifting scene for jobs on Maui, yeah?
Right, and we've been hearing about that since the beginning of the year when we talked about the closure of HCNS.
Yeah.
But more to come. Now, we know that life on Maui is changing. Yesterday, we heard from John Harrison, the Research and Analysis Director at the Maui Economic Development Board. He talked about some of the areas of greatest demographic shift. Today, we're going to look at the jobs market. And with the challenge of the HCNS closure, plus the McKenna Resort and the Sports Authority also popped into there, well, what's the outlook for displaced workers? And construction and visitor expectations nearing the top of the curve, what can those workers and, of course, those starting their work lives on Maui expect to do now that they could perhaps be better prepared for a little later on? Linda Chu Takayama is the State Department of Labor and Industrial Relations Director. She's on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Thanks very much for making time for us today. When we talked last time, we talked exclusively about HCNS and what has been happening or what was happening then with the plans to help workers retread and some of the surveying that you were doing. What have you found since that time?
Well, not all good news, and that is in addition to the dislocated workers from the closing of the last sugar plantation, there are a couple of other potential layoffs coming down the pike. One is the McKenna Beach and Golf Resort, in which we expect that about 372 workers will be losing their jobs with the closing of that resort. In addition, we're not sure exactly what will happen with the transfer of Maui Memorial Hospital to Kaiser and whether all of those employees will be become new employees of Kaiser or whether some of them are actually going to be looking for other jobs. So we're juggling a number of things. Over the course of the last year or so, 2 years maybe, the county of Maui has actually increased its level of jobs by almost 10,000. So the average number of employees in Maui County right now is 72,500. The potential number of layoffs from HCNS, which is 675, plus McKenna, which is 372, plus some of the companies, their vendors that depended on particularly the plantation for work, we figured the number of laid-off workers could be as much as 1,000 by the end of the year.
So, I mean, those are a lot of workers, and certainly for their families looking at how they're going to go forward, that's a big concern. There are also people who are newly entering the job market and wondering if they're going to be able to stay on Maui, perhaps, or not. Looking at the UHERO report that came out a few weeks ago, saying that construction is certainly one of the better aspects of what's happening in the jobs market statewide, but in the counties and on Maui, and looking at the accommodation and food service industries on the neighbor islands, which will continue. But we're still coming up to that top of the curve, Linda. What happens in a couple years when we kind of look over our shoulders and say, well, I guess that was as good as it got, and now we have all these other workers who are going to be scrambling for jobs on Maui that may or may not be there? How do they prepare?
Well, there are a couple of programs in place today that could be helpful and provide some opportunities for these laid-off workers in the future. Programs that include on-the-job training, in which federal monies as well as some state monies will be available to entice employers to hire these workers with some subsidy of their basic salary, so they can learn while working on the job. It benefits the employer as well as the employee. We have found in other kinds of programs that we have had working in other counties that a fairly high percentage, in some industries as much as 90% of the workers that go through these programs are retained by the employer. So we're very hopeful about that. This is going to be particularly useful, we think, in the case of the laid-off sugar workers, because these are folks who are going to have to learn a new skill in order to get a different kind of job. You know, the plantation that closed was the last of its kind, so they're not going to be really able to find another job like it.
But what about in ag per se? Because, you know, they have to be leveraged into something with which they have some familiarity. I mean, I can't imagine them leaving ag altogether, or is that really what you're talking about?
In some cases, that is. For instance, Maui Gold is a pineapple plantation that is trying to revive itself, is looking for workers. It's not exactly the same. And so while agricultural work for a sugar plantation is agriculture, not all agriculture is the same thing. In addition, not all of the workers from the plantation are field workers. There are also a lot of mechanics and scientists and other kinds of administrative type workers that will also be looking for jobs. So we're hoping to be able to transition them into other industries as well. We're also going to be doing a lot of training classes, not necessarily on-the-job training, but classroom-type training. There are also funds available for relocation, if need be, and there are a variety of different kinds of things.
But before we go any further with that one, because our time is running short.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Linda Chutakeyama, I wanted to ask you, as you look out over the next 10, 20 years on Maui, and having seen the dramatic shift in its population over the last 20, what would you tell anyone thinking about moving to Maui, given how that demographic has been shifting? What does Maui need work-wise?
It would be really useful if Maui could develop another industry that probably would be in the manufacturing or construction area. There isn't going to be a large-scale plantation-type environment there ever again. We're going to have to look at something else. Maybe that's the visitor industry. Maybe it's some kind of a manufacturing-type industry. But that generally is the kind of area that provides the most the higher wages and the cleaner industries, which is, I think, something that the county would be interested in looking at.
I hear you say sort of a bigger version of small business.
Yes, yes, that's probably more accurate. It would more likely offer a greater number of jobs. In the meantime, to tide them over, we have these other programs. We also are looking at providing some federal funding for extended unemployment benefits to allow them the time to develop those skills.
Do you see a lot of people having to move away from Maui as they make these transitions, or is this pretty much going to be something, as you say, that's going to tide them over?
That would be an option for them, because elsewhere in the state, we have a very low unemployment rate, much lower, for instance, than the national average. We're at 3.2%, which most economists believe is virtually full employment. So to the extent that there's a more competitive market for employees elsewhere in the state, particularly on Oahu, that may be attractive to families who are able to move, because the opportunities for employment would be greater.
We're going to stop right there, but we'll talk to you soon. Thanks very much for the update and the snapshot.
You're certainly welcome.
Linda Chu Takayama is the state's Department of Labor and Industrial Relations Director. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's now 8:16. Coming up, Kauai Voices celebrate 11 years of performing with a brand new show. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
All this week, we're taking a look at issues on Maui, and for today's backyard quiz, we're looking back to Maui in ancient times. In Hawaiian mythology, the island of Maui is named after the kupua, a heroic trickster who created the Hawaiian Islands. Maui was a demigod whose list of accomplishments include such feats as slowing down the sun, raising the sky, and raising the Hawaiian Islands from the sea. His exploits were usually undertaken in order to solve a problem for friends and family, or to benefit all of mankind. Maui employed both brains and brawn in his actions, and his creation of the Hawaiian Islands was no exception. For today's quiz, we'd like to know what tool the demigod Maui used when he raised the Hawaiian Islands from the seafloor. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get an HPR t-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Eric Conklin from the Nature Conservancy. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
For those fortunate enough to be able to sing and sing well, the opportunity to perform in a choral ensemble can be a source of lifelong enjoyment. The members of Kauai Voices, an audition choir based in Lihue, managed to put together two seasons' worth of performances each year, each with a theme. This time, artistic director Randy Leonard couldn't help noticing how many of the song titles arrayed in front of him had the word ain't in it, and he decided to do something about it. He's on the phone from Lihue. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Pretty good. This is I like this idea because you can fit any kind of songs into it, can't you?
Yeah, and we love doing a variety of different styles of music, so it was a wonderful thing, and it gave us something different to do, something interesting for a theme.
Well, when I first heard of this, Randy, a couple of titles popped into my head, obvious ones, you know, Ain't Misbehaving,
right?
Ain't That a Shame, but I'm sure you found some that you hadn't thought of, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. There's a contemporary piece called The Letter that has it in it. There's a classical choral piece called Without a Song, and it's just a subtle one word in the whole piece that got it, which opened it up to, you know, presenting that. But, yeah, there's a wealth of songs with the word ain't. I was quite surprised.
I'm trying to think of the lyrics to Without a Song, because that one has slipped right by me.
Yeah. It's right at the very, very end of the song that lyric is. And it's a beautiful piece. It's a wonderful choral piece. I can tell you really quickly about that.
Well, I'm just curious.
Without a song, the day would never end. Without a song, the road would never bend. When things go wrong, a man ain't got a friend.
Oh, how about that? Yeah. Well, that's kind of the fun of discovery when you're putting together a show like this, isn't it, Randy?
Absolutely. Little treasures here that you find when you're researching music.
So you've got 30-plus voices for this show, right?
Correct.
How do they line up in terms of pitch, you know, baritones and...
Pretty well balanced. That's one of the goals of putting together Kauai Voices, that we have a very well balanced group, and we have a wonderful blend of songs, of voices, you know, to present the songs and everything. Our mix is very important.
Which, I'm just curious, Randy, which range is hardest to find? Are bass singers hard to find these days?
Right now, bass and tenor are the hardest. Bass has been especially difficult. The men seem to be very busy and not able to fit us into our schedule many times. But we manage. We have some really faithful basses, and we've gotten some new ones also. So.
But it does seem that it would be. I'm surprised that tenors are rare for you, but bass isn't too surprising. It's hard to find that done really well, isn't it?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I feel very fortunate that we have some very talented basses in our group.
This has been a vocation for you for a long time, not just being a singer, not just singing yourself, but getting others to sing and kind of bringing it out of them. When did you sort of find out that was where you were going with your music?
Probably when I was 4 or 5, when I was standing in front of the old black and white TV, and my parents witnessed me leading the music that was on the TV.
you weren't being a soldier; you were being a general from the beginning, huh?
Oh, right from the beginning, yeah. I was leading them in song on the TV, and from that point, they saw my interest and nurtured that, and put me in the right places to learn from some great musicians along the way. And by the time I was 20, when I was in college, I actually got my first professional conducting job with a church in New England.
So when you're conducting a piece like this, you say you've already got your singers trained to have what you consider the right balance of pitch and volume and that kind of thing. What are the things that in performance that you sort of guide them through?
Well, there are nuances to the song. The song is more than notes and pitches and all of that. Especially choral music, it's alive. It's a human creation, and it creates human emotion.
Yeah.
So there are lots of nuances, lots of subtleties as we pass through the song. And one thing that Kauai Voices does, which I've required of them, is that they memorize absolutely everything in the whole show so that their eyes are never distracted going to music. They're on me. And then I can create one unit, one voice out of these 30 and create just subtle nuances that bring out the emotion even more than you would typically hear in many choruses.
That makes a huge difference, because the whole idea of watching musicians watch something else, namely a piece of paper, is sort of a detached experience, isn't it?
It is. And it also, that piece of paper creates a barrier, not only between myself as a conductor and the singers, but between the singers and their audience. Because,
yeah.
you know, there's a more of a connection between the singers and the audience as well without that piece of paper.
Well, you know, when you're performing, it's all too easy to have that piece of paper be a crutch, and you don't, I often feel that you don't really know a song until you've memorized it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and it just allows them to raise the bar on that song and its performance.
You know, when you hear a singer do a song and they're not really conveying to you an understanding of the lyrics, something is lost, don't you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's why, you know, in the 16 weeks leading to the performance, not only are we studying the rhythms and the pitches and such things, we're stopping and we're discovering how to express what that piece means, what the lyrics are about, what the vocal lines are about, and why it's written the way it is, and it puts it all together as we go step by step and week by week.
16 weeks, huh? That's a good preparation, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we have a heavy program. We have 20 pieces that the group performs between the full choir and some soloists that are doing some pieces and some ensembles. So it's a generous amount of material that needs to be prepared perfectly for our audiences.
That is pretty generous, Randy. Well, wish you luck with the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to our audiences enjoying this.
No, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Randy Leonard is the musical director of Kauai Voices, an auditioned choir based in Lihue, Kauai, with 30 to 40 members from age 8 to over 80. Concerts will be performed June 17th through 19th at St. Michael's Church in Lihue with the theme, Ain't That Great Music.
Destination Planet Cure.
I said, I believe that we need a moonshot in this country, an absolute national commitment to end cancer as we know it.
Despite Vice President Biden's enthusiasm, many researchers believe there is no planet cure. Cancer may be revealed by aging and longer lifespans. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio has the largest newsroom of any radio station in Hawaii. HPR produces local programs that make up more than a quarter of what's on our air, and we provide two streams that cover all 8 of our state's major islands. These are just some of the reasons Hawaii residents Tonya Carlson of Honolulu, Celeste Duretz of Makawao, and Michael Nye of Kihei give to their public radio station. Mahalo to all of our members who fill us with pride of place every day. You can join them by donating online at hawaiipublicradio.org or connect with us on Facebook. And thanks. The longline tuna fishing industry says it would lose $7 million in potential revenue under the president's proposed expansion of the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands Marine National Monument. Conservationists say not so, and they're especially upset about letters sent to President Obama by Hawaii lawmakers to dissuade him. Civil Beat Managing Editor Bob Ortega has today's reality check. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, thanks. So is this, at least for the longliners, about the ahi itself or about potential chafing under federal oversight?
Well, ultimately, it's really about the catch. They are concerned that this is going to limit how many big eye tuna they can catch. Now, that's really at the heart of the debate, because what the conservationists are proposing is to expand the current zone of protection around the Northwest Hawaiian Islands from 50 miles out from the islands to 200 miles out. So right now the protections encompass about 140,000 square miles, and this would obviously almost more than quadruple that. So where the tuna industry is arguing is they're saying that this will cut their tuna catch by about 8%, which would be the equivalent of about 2.2 million pounds of fish. The conservationists are saying that this is simply not true. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'd have to say there's some good arguments to some good points that they have raised, which are, as things stand now, the longline tuna guys are going to catch their quota by August. So what the conservationists are arguing essentially is, well, if you've caught your quota by August, then if you go fish outside of this zone, you would have more time to catch fish elsewhere, which actually would wind up meaning that we would have more ahi spread out over the course of the year rather than having it caught all at once in the earlier part of the year, as is the case now.
Part of this also seems to be that they're arguing about the math of how that $7 million was figured out, and also why lawmakers chose to take those figures as being gospel.
Right, right. Well, obviously the lawmakers, are listening to their constituents, who are the tuna fishermen, and so they have taken pretty much those arguments lock, stock, and barrel and used them in the letters that they are sending to the Obama administration, which is currently considering whether or not to expand the marine monument. And that is where the debate starts.
And what about the fact, Bob, that you're talking about sort of, this mobile resource? I mean, the fish don't always stay exactly in one place.
Well, right, right, exactly. And that's the argument that the conservationists are using, which is to say, simply because 8% of your catch right now is inside of the National Monument, that doesn't mean that those fish don't ever leave the monument or that there aren't other fish elsewhere that you can catch. And that's why they are casting doubt on those figures.
So what happens now?
Well, now it'll be up to the federal government and to the Obama administration to decide what to do, taking into account both sets of arguments.
But are they really hearing from conservationists as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. They have been trying to make their case very vocally. So both arguments are out there. We'll see what the administration decides.
You bet. Thanks very much. Talk to you soon.
My pleasure.
Bob Ortega is the managing editor for Civil Beat. He's been sitting in for a few days while Chad Blair is on the East Coast.
Good morning. It's 8:32. I'm Chris Vandercook, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. You can get in touch with us through our talkback line at 808-792-8217. On Facebook, you can find us at Hawaii Conversation. On Twitter, at HI Conversation, or BKOZHPR. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, breaking the presidential glass ceiling, and later, a contemporary take on an ancient tale.
Hillary Clinton breaks through an historic glass ceiling. The worst week of the Donald Trump campaign, and six states vote in a very big day in American politics. That's some of what's percolating in the thoughts of news analyst Neil Conan today, and he joins us now, as he does most Tuesdays, from his MacNut farm on the Big Island. Good morning, Neil.
And to you, Beth Ann, on a day unlike any other in American history.
Yes, indeed. And we now know that a woman will be the presidential nominee of a major political party for the first time, at least according to the delegate tally of the Associated Press.
Almost exactly 8 years to the day after an African-American broke through that very same barrier. And like Barack Obama in 2008, Hillary Clinton has a lot left to do to unify her party and go on to win the presidency. But before we, go on and plunge into those last few primaries, I think it's a moment to step back and consider this. It is both symbol and substance. It's one of those meaningful steps that in retrospect look inevitable, but it was a long, long time coming and very hard won.
Mm. Was it something of an anticlimax at that moment that came on a quiet Monday afternoon instead of amidst all the confetti and falderal and balloons and everything that we're going to see tonight at Clinton headquarters in Brooklyn?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but it might, that might be a bit of an anticlimax too, if California doesn't go her way. That and a bunch of other problems are going to make this an interesting day for Secretary Clinton, but a new day, and nevertheless, the very first day when she woke up to when she woke up as the presumptive nominee.
Well, it's not just California today, though. I mean, there are six states, and you mentioned last week New Jersey and New Mexico, North and South Dakota, Montana.
And let's not overlook the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, where Clinton won big majorities over the weekend, and the District of Columbia, where she will run up big majorities a week from today. Bernie Sanders should win today in Montana and the Dakotas. Hillary Clinton will win in New Jersey. New Mexico and California should be close.
Now, Sanders supporters say that all of this is really premature, that it's just wrong to count superdelegates who could change their minds before the vote at the convention in July. What do you say?
That is true so far as it goes. But, you know, the most important superdelegate of them all called Bernie Sanders on Sunday, and we don't know exactly what President Obama told him. But according to reports, he said he's planning to endorse Hillary Clinton as soon as tomorrow. Now, once that happens, you know, there's really no chance that 500 other superdelegates are going to change their minds. Senator Sanders plans to head home to Vermont after his election night rally tonight in Santa Monica. He may decide it's important to keep his word and hold out, you know, a concession until Philadelphia. But, I think most Democrats expect the tone to change after tonight.
So California really could be his last hurrah.
It's going to be really hard for him and his supporters the next few days and weeks, no matter what happens. Now, look, he ran much longer and much more effectively than anyone expected, including in California. The polls there give Clinton a slight edge, but Sanders could certainly win. If he doesn't, some of his supporters will argue that, you know, that AP delegate tally yesterday, you know, damped down the turnout. This was just the latest example of, you know, a rigged system. And, you know, whatever happens with the vote, just as it's going to be important for Clinton to reach out to Sanders on social justice issues and minimum wage and student debt, it's going to be important for him to acknowledge that he lost fair and square, that he needs to damp down the conspiracy theories and keep his pledge to do everything he can to beat Donald Trump.
Which, of course, brings us to the prospective Republican nominee, who spent much of the past week alienating party leaders who had just started to rally around him. What's up with that?
Party leaders like the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who are dumbfounded by Trump's unrelenting tirades against the federal judge who's hearing two class action lawsuits from former students of Trump University just today. Paul Ryan said what Trump says is the textbook definition of racism. He deplores it. He thinks, you know, it's awful, it's wrongheaded, but of course he still supports Trump. But, you know, this behavior from Trump is inexplicable. It refocuses attention on Trump University, which makes him look bad. He makes these racist remarks, which makes him look horrible. And he forces all those Republicans who just endorsed him to gag. Even Newt Gingrich, who's been openly angling for the vice presidential slot. And Trump just won't let it go. He reprimanded staffers who wanted to get his campaign past this. And that makes him look exactly like, you know, the sort of dangerously unhinged character that Hillary Clinton described in that very effective speech she made last week. You know, a would-be president of the United States who race baits a federal judge. Now, suddenly every Republican candidate understands that they're going to have to answer for every crazy thing that Donald Trump says between now and November. Is he a racist? Are you a racist for supporting him? You know, it's just a nightmare.
Okay, so let me ask you a more practical question. You know, Trump spent the last, much of the last 2 weeks, at least in California. This is long after his last rival dropped out. Does this mean that the outcome of the primary kind of doesn't matter, that if it's a state that he can't win in November? Well, what's he doing in California? I mean, it just made it ripe for all of the things that you just talked about.
Absolutely. It's a very good question that a lot of Republican professionals are asking, too. Now, these are precious weeks where he could be campaigning, you know, unopposed in places like Florida and Ohio and Pennsylvania, real swing states, while Hillary Clinton still fends off Bernie Sanders in California. He's also been slow to build the campaign apparatus he's going to need, you know, state chairman, you know, fundraising staff. He held one big fundraiser in California. Hillary Clinton has held 17. He still has almost no communication staff. Now, Trump had a month to work on all that, get ready for the convention and for the general election, and it's been an opportunity squandered. Between that and the attacks on the judge and the Trump University affidavits and Clinton's speech, it's just been a terrible week for Donald Trump, a week that deeply shook his supporters and leaves him on the defensive. Beth Ann, before we wrap this up, I wanted to ask you a question about the Senate race in California. Now, longtime Democrat Barbara Boxer is retiring, so the Senate seat is open. The favorite is Kamala Harris, the state attorney general. If polls are to be believed, she will face off against Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez in November. And besides the fact that they're both women, what else do they have in common?
They're both Democrats.
Ding, ding, ding. California has an open primary system. It's not a Democratic primary or a Republican primary. It's open to all. The top two then face off in November. Now, that can be two Republicans in a deep red congressional district like Orange County. It could be two Democrats in San Francisco. In general, the idea should favor moderates. If there was a Republican-only primary in Orange County, for example, the more moderate Republican would be worrying about a challenge from the right. And whoever won that low turnout Republican primary would almost certainly win in November. In an open primary, after the more moderate Republican and, you know, the Tea Party candidate finished 1-2 in June, the moderate would be better placed to win the votes of independents and Democrats come November.
And then the great prize of a U.S. Senate seat, it looks like, you know, of course, the Democrats are going to finish 1-2 in the primary.
Exactly. In a state where one of the major parties is very weak, an open primary should produce more competitive races in November. And, you know, and I wonder, Beth-Ann, can you think of any other state where the Republican Party is almost moribund and which might benefit from competitive elections come November?
How about the one about three time zones, say, to the west?
That's exactly right. You know, it might be a good thing, too, in Alaska, where Democrats are weak. And one more thing about that California Senate race, as long as we're talking about political history today, Loretta Sanchez would be the first Latina ever elected to the U.S. Senate, and Kamala Harris would be just the second African-American woman after Carol Moseley Braun of Illinois.
And if I remember correctly, when she decided not to run again, that Illinois seat, Senate seat, was won by one Barack Obama.
It all goes round and round.
It does, which means we'll come round to you again in a couple of weeks. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you next week, Beth Ann.
Oh, that's right. Next week you'll be here with us. Thanks a bunch.
Yeah.
Let's talk to you then. News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his specific news minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. Now we're going to get back to the backyard quiz. Today we wanted to know about how the Hawaiian demigod Maui created the Hawaiian Islands. Maui belongs to a group of Hawaiian mythological figures known as kupuas. Some were cruel, others were kindly demigods. Maui was of the friendly persuasion. He once used a lasso to slow down the sun so his mother could dry her kapa. When he saw that the sky was too low, preventing the people of Earth from standing straight up, Maui and his father journeyed to Lahaina and pushed the sky to its current level, saving humanity from being crushed under its weight. But the feat Maui is most remembered for is his creation of the Hawaiian Islands. The legend goes that Maui convinced his three brothers to take him fishing. When they weren't looking, Maui stuck his fish hook in the seafloor and tricked his brothers into thinking they had caught a very large fish. Maui told his brothers to paddle with all their strength, and in their exertion, they didn't notice that there was an island rising behind them. Maui repeated that trick several times, thus creating the Hawaiian Islands. In today's quiz, we specifically asked you what tool Maui used to create the Hawaiian Islands, and it is, of course, the fish hook.
And Beth Ann, David Rohner of Kaimuki knew the answer to that. Congratulations, David. A T-shirt is coming your way at 8:47. And if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the backyard quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
There's a lot of bad blood between the rat and the octopus. As the ancient Polynesian story goes, the octopus once rescued the rat from drowning, only to be rewarded with a display of ingratitude that the octopus has resented ever since. The story is the inspiration for a new multimedia art show by the Hawaii Island-based Agriculture Collective. Scott Yole is one of four artists in agriculture, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Chris.
We should probably set the stage by telling this story, but I got to say that I can understand why the octopus is upset, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. If somebody defecated on my head, I'd be a little upset, too.
Which is, so the rat is in a boat that capsizes, right?
Correct.
And?
So the boat is, throughout Polynesia, the myths exist through different Polynesian cultures, and the story is told slightly different in each culture. Mm-hmm. But essentially the myth takes place out at sea. The rat has been stranded. Whether the boat has sunk or the ocean levels have risen on an atoll, but the rat is set adrift at sea, and an octopus happens to be coming by. And the rat strikes a deal with the octopus to take him shore, and in return, the rat would promise him a gift. And when he got to shore, he defecates on the octopus's head and then runs away. And in different mythologies, different versions of the myth, I should say, either octopus received the ink as a gift or his suction cups as a gift, but he still is begrudging the rat for taking off and the gift he left on his head.
So, you know, as with so many stories of this kind, it can be taken any number of different ways, right?
Absolutely. Well, that's the beauty of myth, right? Myth. Essentially, the truths are still there, but the stories, you know, retold over and over again through oral tradition, through art making.
Yeah, I mean, there's a similarity to the story of the scorpion and the frog, right?
Correct.
But that you also wonder about how stories like this are shared from culture to culture, you know, basically the idea of dealing with ingratitude, betrayal of friendship, that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, the idea that for us in regards to our approach to it, we thought a lot about, broken promises, about, we've kind of projected different ideas of kind of present-day issues in terms of corporate greed or, promises broken, promises kept, the idea of a handshake or shady deals.
And so with four different artists and that sort of broad a brush to start with, there's any number of things you can end up with, right?
Absolutely. We all have our own take on it, and that kind of how we presented the exhibition with collaboration as well as individual work.
Scott, what are your media of choice?
I'm more of a conceptual based artist. I use a lot of mediums. I think of as medium as language. And some things sound better in French than they do in English.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I'm using drawing or video art or sculpture, it's usually the medium, or the idea dictates the medium or the language I choose to express that in.
And that's a very contemporary approach to art, isn't it, as opposed to sticking with a particular medium or specialty?
Absolutely. It's I wouldn't say it's necessarily new, but definitely it's more evident from Duchamp on, so...
Yeah.
Prior to that.
Well, I guess, as you say, Duchamp on, that's getting, it's going to be heading for a century old before too long, isn't it? So it's not exactly yesterday's idea, is it?
Absolutely not.
But it's got a lot of, it's still a whole approach that has a lot left to say in it. And having a multimedia approach with this kind of lets you go in a lot of different directions, I would think.
Absolutely, and all the artists in our collaborative group work in different ways. Margot Ray's a printmaker, and as well as a collage-based artist who does installation. Keith sees himself as a talent as a painter, but does installation-based work and sculptural work as well. Sally Lumbar comes in with a background of documentary filmmaking, photography, as well as installation. So we all have very, very, you know, different approaches to making art and use different materials and mediums. But I think that's what makes the exhibition rich, well, and many exhibitions rich.
Then you have the challenge then with this very disparate approaches to creating a somewhat unified exhibition with the work of four different artists, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of compromise, and, you know, there's certain things that, you know, each of us aren't willing to let go of, and other times you just have to say, okay, I need to put that aside and work with this idea, and, you know, in order to make, especially the collaborative pieces come together that we worked on. In the
sure. But, you know, a work that exists in one form in a studio becomes something entirely different once you change the space it's in, especially with the kind of conceptual art you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. I think the space, you know, always dictates, the way you present things. I always think of installation actually as sculpting space. And then as soon as you get into for example, a museum space or gallery space, then you also bring another person into the collaboration, which is the curator.
Sure. But that your feeling is that collaboration has worked, right?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think collaboration always works, but I think it's for us. We started our collaborative group as an opportunity to help promote ourselves and show our own work, as well as help promote other artists. In this particular show, we've been working on a project for over 2 years, and the start of the project actually was over 3 years. And for us, we've had, you know, the time to kind of work through the ideas and, constant revision and editing to the whole artistic process, allowed us to kind of bring our ideas together. And even once we got into this space, it was installing, you know, the exhibition and making decisions while we were in there, over a week's period of time, to make the work flow through the space, to think about what we want the viewer to see first, what do we want them to see last, how do we want them to experience the video installation, yeah.
Well, Scott, it sounds like an exciting show, and I thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Scott Yole is one of four artists in the Hawaii Island-based art collective Agroculture, along with Sally Lundberg, Keith Tallett, and Margot Ray. The Rat and the Octopus runs until August 4th at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's Schaefer International Gallery, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
In 2016 marks 400 years since William Shakespeare's death, and with the nationwide tour of the Bard's First Folio, we thought we'd revisit writer Arthur Phillips.
It's part of being a basically well-educated person in the United States. You're supposed to like Shakespeare, and you're supposed to know something about it. And beyond that, you're not required to go much further.
Discover what Arthur Phillips learned from Shakespeare with his fifth novel, The Tragedy of Arthur, on New Letters on the Air.
This evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
Beth Ann, there's so much that is unpredictable, even with what we know about the coming election season, because in past election seasons, we've had a party standard bearer, and local officials have run under the standard of the party. There was a platform. All that seems to have broken apart.
You're talking about with Donald Trump.
With Donald Trump, yeah.
He's kind of creating. What's been happening the last week?
it's a make up your platform as you go along platform.
As someone said to me, this is the scariest presidential campaign that he has ever witnessed. And maybe that's true for you, too. We'll talk more about it. We're going to certainly know more a lot later today. But already we know that it's going to be a Clinton-Trump matchup, as we had forecast.
That's right.
That's going to do it for us for today. But coming up tomorrow, well, one change that most people on Maui would welcome would be an end to homelessness. We're going to talk with Monique Yamashita. She's the executive director of Kahale o Ke Ola. And she's going to give us an update on the view from the ground.
And we'll check in with UH Manoa's Voices of Aloha in the middle of their mainland tour.
You can call our talkback line anytime you like and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Past shows can be found under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.